cannot separate myself from them. They are cast down because they're destitute or diseased or blind or widowed, because they carry firewood on the Sabbath, because they're not born a Jew but a Samaritan, or they're born outside of marriage. He spoke like someone whose heart had overflowed its banks. They are condemned as impure, but God is love. He would not be so cruel as to condemn them. I didn't answer. I think he was struggling to understand why God, his new father, did not plead more insistently with his people to take these outcasts in, just as Jesus' father, Joseph, had pled with the rabbi to let him into synagogue school. Sometimes I can't bear what I see around me. Rome occupies our land. Jews sympathize with them. Jerusalem is filled with corrupt temple priests. When I come to pray here, I ask God to bring his kingdom to earth. It cannot come soon enough. He went on speaking of God's kingdom much like Judas did, as a government free of Rome, with a Jewish king and righteous rule, but also as a great feast of compassion and justice. At our last meeting, I'd called him a stonemason, a carpenter, a yarn sorter, and a fisherman. I saw now he was, in truth, a sage, and perhaps like Judas, an agitator. But even that didn't fully explain him. I knew of no one who put compassion above holiness. Our religion might preach love, but it was based on purity. God was holy and pure, therefore we must be holy and pure. But here was a poor mamzer saying God is love, therefore we must be love. I said, "You speak as if God's kingdom is not just a place on earth, but a place inside us." "So I believe." "Then does God live in the temple in Jerusalem, or in this kingdom inside us?" "Can he not live in both?" he asked. I felt a sudden blazing up inside and threw my arms open. "Can he not live everywhere?" His laughter resounded off the cave walls, but his smile lingered on me. "I think for you, too, God cannot be contained." Having grown chilled in the shade, I went to sit on a rock in the sun, thinking of the endless debates I'd held in my head about God. I'd been taught God was a figure similar to humans, only vastly more powerful, which failed to comfort me because people could be so utterly disappointing. It reassured me suddenly to think of God not as a person like ourselves, but as an essence that lived everywhere. God could be love, as Jesus believed. For me, he would be I am who I am, the beingness in our midst. Jesus gazed toward the sky as if to judge the hour, and in the hush of that moment, in my exhilaration of being near him, of conversing with him about divine immensities, I said, "Why should we contain God any longer in our poor and narrow conceptions, which are so often no more than grandiose reflections of ourselves? Let us set him free." His laugh rose and fell, and rose again, and I told myself I could love him for that alone. "I would like to hear further how we might set God free," he said, "but I must be on my way. I work now at the amphitheater."
"No longer in the quarry?"
"No. I'm glad to be in the open air. I hew stones into blocks that will serve as seats. Perhaps one day you'll attend the theater and sit on a stone I myself have chiseled and fitted." We'd found our alikeness, our bond, but his words, though meant kindly, reminded me of how we were divided. He was the one who hewed the stone. I was the one who sat on it. I watched him fasten his tool belt. He hadn't asked me why I'd come here. Perhaps he thought it would be prying, or he assumed I was simply walking in the hills as I'd claimed before. But I wished now to tell him. Nothing hidden. "I'm a scribe," I said. The audacity of the claim momentarily stalled my breath. Since I was 8, my father has allowed me to study and write. But when I was betrothed, the privilege was taken from me and my scrolls were burned. I salvaged what I could of them and buried them in this cave. I came this morning to dig them up.
"I could tell you were different from other women. It wasn't very difficult."
He looked back at my digging tool balanced on the rock.
"I'll help you."
"No," I said quickly. I wanted to do it alone. I wasn't ready for him to see my writings, my bowl, or the curse I'd written. "You mustn't tarry. I'll dig them up myself. I spoke of them because I wish you to know and understand me." He offered me a parting smile and strode off toward the balsams. Finding the spot where my treasure was buried, I drove the tool into the hard-packed dirt.
32. 8 days later, Herod Antipas summoned me to the palace to view the completed mosaic. I'd sworn never to return and begged to be excused, but Father refused my pleas. I feared defying him too strongly. I couldn't risk ruining my newfound freedom. Already I'd made a fine new ink, and working through the mornings and sometimes at night, I'd completed my narratives of the women in the scriptures who'd been raped. I'd bound them together with Tabitha's story. I named them The Tales of Terror. At mid-afternoon, my father accompanied me to the palace, making an uncommon effort at appeasement. Did I find the papyri he'd brought me to my liking? Was I pleased to have Phasaelus as a friend in the palace? Was I aware that while Herod Antipas was thought to be ruthless, he was kindly to those loyal to him? I began to hear a noise in my head, a voice of warning. Something was not quite right. Antipas, Phasaelus, and my father gazed at the mosaic as if it had been dropped from heaven. I could barely bring myself to look at it. The tiny tiles replicated my face with near perfection. They shimmered in the dimness of the frigidarium, the lips seeming to part, the eyes blinking, a deception, a trick of light. I watched them watching it, Herod Antipas leering, his eyes hungry and salivating, and Phasaelus too crafty not to see his lust. My father had placed himself between me and Antipas as if forming a barrier. Now and then he patted the place between my shoulders, but rather than comforting me, his unctuous behavior added to my wariness. "Your face is beautiful," Phasaelus said. "I see that my husband thinks so, too." Antipas's philandering was well known, and so, too, was Phasaelus's intolerance of it. In the Nabatean kingdom of her father, infidelity was regarded as a heinous disrespect to a wife. "Leave us," he bellowed at her. She turned and addressed me so all could hear. "Be cautious. I know my husband well. But whatever happens, don't fear. We shall still be friends." He shouted again, "Leave us!" She walked out slowly, as if departing was her idea. I wanted to rush after her. "Take me with you." Something treacherous had slipped into the room. I felt it on the back of my neck. Antipas took my hand, resisting my tug to pull it away. He said, "I would have you for my concubine." I jerked my hand from him and stepped backward until the back of my knees collided with the stone bench that encircled the wall. I sank onto it. Concubine. The word slithered before me on the floor. Father came and sat beside me, leaving Antipas to stand alone beside the mosaic, arms crossed over his belly. Father spoke in a low, groveling tone that was foreign to my ears. "Anna, daughter of mine, for you to be the concubine of the Tetrarch is the best we can hope. You would be like a second wife." I turned narrowed eyes on him. "I would be what they whisper I am, a harlot." "A concubine is not a harlot. She is faithful to one man. She differs from a wife only in the status of her children." I realized he had agreed to this despicable notion already, yet he seemed to want my consent. He couldn't risk me inflaming Antipas with my disgust and rejection. His status in the Tetrarch's court would surely be affected. Our fathers, Abraham and Jacob, had concubines that bore them children. King Saul and King Solomon kept concubines, as did Herod Antipas' own father, King Herod. There is no shame in it. There's shame in it for me. Across the room, Antipas watched us. His eyes glowed yellow, a fat hawk judging his prey. "I will not consent. You must be reasonable," he said, angering. "You are no longer marriageable. I can find no husband for you now that you are widowed and besmirched, but the Tetrarch of all of Galilee and Perea will have you. You'll live in the palace and be well cared for. Phasaelus has promised to befriend you, and Antipas has granted my request that you be allowed to read, write, and study to your content." I stared straight ahead. "A concubine does not receive a bride price," he went on, "yet Antipas has agreed to pay the sum of 2 manas. It shows your great worth. There will be a contract drawn to protect your rights." His patience exhausted, Antipas strode across the room and stood before me. "I've prepared a gift for you." He motioned to his steward, Chuza, who brought a tray laden with a stack of ivory sheets like the one on which Phasaelus had sent her invitation. There were reed pens and vials of dyed inks, 2 green, 1 blue, 3 red. He was followed by a servant who carried a sloped lap desk made from red wood and carved with two dragons. The sight of these things created both longing and nausea in me. I pressed the back of my hand to my mouth. "My answer is no," Antipas shouted at my father. "Why doesn't she obey as women should?" I leapt to my feet. "I will never submit," I said. I looked at the lap desk and the tray bearing his gifts, all that beauty and bounty, and on impulse I picked up a single sheet of the ivory and slid it into the pocket inside my sleeve. "I take this as your parting gift to me," I said, and turning, I fled the room. Behind me, I heard Antipas shout, "Chuza, bring her back!" I broke into a run. 33. On the street, I pulled my mantle over my head and walked briskly, staying beneath the roofed sidewalks along the Cardo, looking behind me for Chuza, and now and then entering a small shop in hopes of avoiding him. It was the day before the Sabbath, and the city was thronged with people. I tried my best to disappear among them. I thought of hiding myself in the cave, a shelter no one but Jesus and Lavi knew about, but I could not sleep or eat there, nor would Jesus come at this hour. He would be at the building site for the theater on the northern slope. The realization halted me, as if a hand had been laid on my shoulder. I heard Yalva's voice float up. "Your moment will come, and when it does, you must seize it with all the bravery you can find. Your moment will come, because you'll make it come." I turned toward the northern slope. The building site was a commotion of pounding mallets and pluming limestone dust. I stood on the street and stared at two-wheeled carts lurching through the bustle, wooden cranes and hoists lifting unhewn stones, men stirring mortar with long staves. I hadn't expected so many workers. I spotted him finally near the top of the ridge, bent over a stone, smoothing it with a trowel. The sun was dipping toward the valley, and the shadow from a nearby scaffold fell across his back, forming a tiny ladder. The poet's words began to sing in me of their own accord. "Under the apple tree I awakened you. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it." Around me the street was busy with vendors peddling tools, bolts of cheap flax, butchered animals, and stews for the workers, a second-rate bazaar compared to the market in the basilica. I found a spot beside a vegetable stall where I could wait for the day's labor to end. The sun slid deeper into the valley, and my spirits thinned with the slippage of light. Lost in my brooding, I jumped at the sound of a ram's horn being blown. Abruptly, the hammering ceased and the men began to put away their tools. They streamed up the hill onto the street, Jesus among them, his cheeks and forehead dusted with stone powder. A man shouted, "Seize her!" Jesus turned toward the cry, and then I too reeled about. Chuza stood on the sidewalk a short distance from me, pointing. "Seize her!" he cried again. "She has stolen from my master!" Workers, vendors, shoppers, passers-by stopped, the street muted. I drew back into the market stall, yet he followed me into the baskets of onions and chickpeas. He was an old man, but he was strong. Grabbing my wrist, he dragged me into the crowd, into their stares and spit and invective. Hemmed in by a host of angered people, I was struck with fear like a slash of lightning moving from the crown of my head, down my back, along my legs, to the nubs of my toes. I looked at the sky, the breath gone from me. Chuza lifted his voice. "I charge her with thievery and blasphemy. She stole a precious sheet of ivory from my master, and she sat for an artisan while he made a graven image of her face." I closed my eyes and felt the heaviness of my lashes. "I have stolen nothing." Ignoring me, he spoke to the crowd. "If there's no ivory in the pocket of her sleeve, I will be satisfied she's not a thief. Either way, she cannot deny the graven image made of her face." A woman pushed her way through the swarm of people. "She's the daughter of Matthias, head scribe to Herod Antipas, and known to be a fornicator." I called out again in protest, but my denial was swallowed by the black odium that boiled out of their hearts. "Show us your pocket," a man yelled. One by one, they took up the petition. Gripping my forearm, Chuza let their shouts grow fevered before he reached for my sleeve. I writhed and kicked. I was a fluttering moth, a hapless girl. My skirmish yielded nothing but jeers and laughter. He snatched the sheet of ivory from my coat and lifted it over his head. A roar erupted. "She is a thief," A blasphemer and a fornicator, Chuzza cried. What would you do with her? Stone her, someone cried. The chant began, the dark prayer. Stone her, stone her. I shut my eyes against the dazzling blur of anger. Their hearts are boulders and their heads are straw. They seem to be not a multitude of persons, but a single creature, a behemoth feeding off their combined fury. They would stone me for all the wrongs ever done to them. They would stone me for God. Most often, victims were dragged to a cliff outside the city and thrown off before being pelted, which lessened the laborious effort of having to throw so many stones. It was, in some way, more merciful, at least quicker. But I saw I would not be accorded that lenience. Men and women and children plucked stones from the ground. These stones, God's most bountiful gift to Galilee. Some rushed into the building site where the stones were larger and more deadly. I heard the sizzle of a rock fly over my head and fall behind me. Then the commotion and noise slowed, elongating, receding to some distant pinnacle, and in that strange slackening of time I no longer cared to fight. I felt myself bending to my fate. I ached for the life I would never live, but I yearned even more to escape it. I sank onto the ground, making myself as small as I could, my arms and legs tucked beneath my chest and belly, my forehead pressed to the ground. I fashioned myself into a walnut shell. I would be broken apart and God could have the meat. A stone struck my hip in a sunburst of pain. Another fell beside my ear. I heard the stomp of sandals running toward me, then a voice glittering with indignation. Cease your violence! Would you stone her on the word of this man? The mob quieted, and I dared to raise my head. Jesus stood before them, his back to me. I stared at the bones in his shoulders, the way his hands were drawn into fists, how he'd planted himself between me and the stones. Chuzza, though, was more fox than father, more jackal than Antipas. He diverted the rabble from Jesus's question. She had the ivory, you saw it for yourself. I felt life returning to me. I did not steal it, it was a gift! I exclaimed, getting to my feet. Jesus's voice boomed. I ask you again, who is this accuser whose word you take so easily? When no one spoke, Jesus shouted even louder. Answer me! Knowing that anyone associated with Herod Antipas would be suspect to them, I called out, He is Chuzza, the steward of Herod Antipas! Which brought an eruption of mutterings. Someone shouted at Chuzza, Are you Herod Antipas's sycophant? Do not ask who I am, Chuzza cried. Ask who this man is. Who is he to speak for her? He has no standing here. Only her father, husband, or brother can speak for her. Is he one of these? Jesus turned and looked at me, and I saw his anger in the set of his jaw. I am Jesus ben Joseph, he said, turning back to them. I am neither father, brother, nor husband to her, but I will soon be her betrothed. I can testify she is no thief, or blasphemer, or fornicator. My heart caught. I looked at him in confusion and strained to understand if what he'd just declared was his true intention or a shrewd means to save me. I could not tell. I remembered him in the cave, how he'd shared my breakfast, how he'd come to stand beside me when I'd poured out my shame, all that we'd made known to each other. There was a lull as the crowd deliberated whether to believe Jesus' witness over Chuzza's. Jesus was one of them, and he'd pledged himself to be my upholder. Chuzza was the minion of their despised tetrarch. The crowd's ferocity was draining away. I could feel it leaving. Yet they went on, standing there, glaring, clutching stones in their fists. Jesus lifted out his palms to them. Let the one who is without sin cast the next stone. A moment passed, a tiny lifetime. I listened to the sound of dropping stones. They were like mountains moving. 34. Jesus remained beside me until Chuzza slunk away and the mob disbanded. I was shaken by the savagery of the crowd and my bare escape from death, and he seemed reluctant to leave me to myself. He gazed at the diminishing light. I will walk with you as far as your house. Were you injured? He asked as we set out. Though my hip throbbed from the single stone that had struck me, I shook my head. His declaration that I would soon be his betrothed was like a fire in my head. I wanted to ask what he'd meant, whether his admission had been sincere or was calculated to win over the crowd, but I was afraid of his answer. Quiet fell. The city floated in a soupy twilight, his face half in shadow. The silence lasted only moments, but I thought I might choke on it. In an effort to breathe, I recounted the unexpurgated story of the mosaic, how I'd agreed to sit for it in order to save my brother, Judas. When I told him of Antipas's lust, of his intent to make me his concubine, and described my panicked escape to the building site, I saw the anger flare again at his jaw. I confessed that the sheet of ivory, which was back again in my sleeve, had perhaps been more taken than given. I wanted him to know the truth, but I had the sense that my chatter was making matters worse, entirely worse. He listened. He asked no questions. Upon reaching the gate of our palatial house, I stared at my feet. It was excruciating to look at him. Finally, lifting my face, I said, "I doubt I'll see you again, but please know I will always be grateful for what you did. I would be dead if not for you." His forehead wrinkled, and I saw disappointment in his eyes. When I told the crowd we would soon be betrothed, I didn't mean to assume your answer. He said, "I overstepped in an effort to assert my authority with them. I accept your refusal. We shall part well, as friends. But I didn't think you meant the betrothal seriously," I said. "We walked all this way and you said nothing." He smiled. "We walked all this way with you talking." I laughed, but my face burned, and I was glad for the gathering darkness. "I'm required to marry," he said. "All Jewish men are. The Talmud does not sanction a man without a wife."
"Are you saying you're required to marry, therefore you'll settle on me?"
"No. I'm trying to say men are required to marry, but I often see things differently than others. It may be that for some men it's better not to marry. I thought that was true of me. Before my father died, he wanted to arrange a betrothal for me, but I couldn't agree to it."
I stared at him, bewildered.
"Are you saying you're not meant for marriage, but it's a duty you must endure?" "No, only listen."
"I would not.
Why would it be required for some not to marry? Why would you be among a group such as that? Anna, hear me. There are men who are summoned to something even more pressing than marriage. They're called to go about the country as prophets or preachers, and they must be willing to give up everything. They must leave their families behind for the sake of bringing God's kingdom. They cannot give themselves to both. Wouldn't it be better to never marry than to abandon their wives and children?"
"You believe you're one of these? A prophet or a preacher?"
He turned his face from me. "I don't know." I watched him press the tips of his thumb and forefinger between his brows and squeeze. "Since I was a boy of 12, I've felt I might have some purpose in God's mind, but that seems less likely to me now. I've had no sign. God has not spoken to me. Since my father died, it has been pressed on me anew that I'm the eldest son. My mother, sister, and brothers depend on me. It would be difficult to leave them with little provision." He faced me again. "I've wrestled with it, and more I think the calling I sensed was more in my own mind than in God's."
"You are sure?" I said.
"Because I was not. I cannot know for certain, but for now God is silent on the matter, and I've come to believe I can't forsake my family and leave them to fend for themselves. The truth of these things has set me free to think of marriage."
"You think of me like the fulfillment of a duty, then?"
"I'm compelled by duty, yes, I won't deny it. But I would not speak of a betrothal to you if I weren't also compelled by what's in my heart."
"And what's in your heart?" I wanted to ask, but the question was brash and dangerous, and I sensed that what lay there was a difficult puzzle, a jumble of God, destiny, duty, and love that couldn't be solved, much less explained.
"If we married, I would always look over my shoulder for God."
"I'm unsuited for you," I said.
"Certainly you know this." I couldn't think why I would try to discourage him except to test his resolve. "I don't just refer to my family's wealth and ties to Herod Antipas, but to myself."
"You said you're not like other men."
"Well, I'm not like other women. You've said so yourself. I have ambitions as men do. I'm racked with longings. I'm selfish and willful and sometimes deceitful. I rebel. I'm easy to anger. I doubt the ways of God. I'm an outsider everywhere I go. People look on me with derision.
I know all of this, he said. And you would still have me? Question is whether you will have me.
I heard Sophia sigh into the wind. Here, Anna, here it is. And despite all that Jesus had just said, all his prevarication and provisos, the most curious feeling came over me that I was always meant to arrive at this moment. I said, I will have you. 35. Having no father or elder brother, Jesus bore the responsibility of arranging his own betrothal. He promised to return in the morning to speak with my father, a pledge that rendered me almost impervious to the anger I encountered when I entered the house. In retaliation for my refusal to be his concubine, the Tetrarch had demoted Father from head scribe and counselor to a mere scribe among many other mere scribes. It was a dazzling fall from favor. Father was livid with me. I couldn't feel bad for him. His willingness to hand me over, first to Nathaniel, then to Herod Antipas, had severed the last tie that bound me to him. I knew somehow he would find a way to ingratiate himself to Antipas once again and recover his position. I would be proven right about that. As Father berated me that night, Mother paced back and forth, interrupting him with outbursts of fury. They didn't even know yet that the good citizens of Sepphoris had nearly stoned me to death for reasons of thievery, fornication, and blasphemy. I decided to let them discover this on their own. "Do you think of no one but yourself?" Mother shrieked. "Why do you persist in these shameful acts of disobedience? Would you rather I'd become Herod Antipas's concubine?" I asked, genuinely shocked. "Would that not be an act even more shameful? I would rather you had..." She cut herself off, leaving the rest unspoken but hanging conspicuously in the air. "I would rather you had never been born." A palace courier arrived the following morning before Father broke his fast. I was perched on the balcony awaiting Jesus' arrival when Lavi ushered the messenger into Father's study. Had Father struck some deal with Herod Antipas during the night? Would I be dragged off to become his concubine after all? Where was Jesus? Their meeting was short. I stepped away from the rail as Father emerged. When the courier departed, his voice drifted up to me. "I know you're there, Anna." I peered down. He looked defeated, his posture slumping toward the floor. He said, "Last evening, I sent a message, imploring Hera to set aside your refusal and take you for his concubine anyway, hoping the humiliation you'd caused him might have subsided. His response has just arrived. He ridiculed me for thinking he would condescend to have you in his palace after you were nearly stoned on the street. You might have told me of this and saved me from further disgrace." He shook his head in disbelief. "A stoning? The city will be set against us even more. You have ruined us." Had I dared, I would have asked if he cared at all that I'd endured a harrowing escape from death. I would have told him it was Chizza he should blame for the stoning, not me. But I held my tongue. He walked back toward his study, a man utterly vanquished, then stopped midway. Without turning, he spoke. "I do give thanks you were unharmed. I'm told it was a builder who prevented your death." "Yes, his name is Jesus."
"And he spoke to the crowd of becoming your betrothed?"
"Yes."
"Would you welcome that, Anna?"
"I would, Father, with all my heart."
When Jesus arrived soon afterward, Father wrote and signed a contract of betrothal without consulting Mother. Jesus would pay the humble bride price of 30 shekels and would feed, clothe, and shelter my aunt, who would accompany me. There would be no betrothal ceremony. The wedding would be a simple transfer from my father's house to my husband's in 30 days, on the 3rd of Nisan, the shortest time allowed. Nazareth, 17-27 CE. 1. The day I entered Jesus' house, his family stood in a silent clump in the courtyard, watching as Lavi led the cart containing me, my aunt, and our belongings through the gate. There were 4 of them,
two men besides Jesus, and two women, one of whom rested her hand across her nearly imperceptible pregnant belly. "Do they think we have the spaciousness of a palace?" I heard the pregnant one say. To my mind, we'd brought a bare handful of possessions. I'd packed the plainest of my clothes, one ordinary silver headband, my copper mirror, an ornamental brass comb, two red woolen rugs, undyed bed coverings, my incantation bowl, and most precious of all, my cedar chest. Inside it were my scrolls, reed pens, a sharpening knife, two vials of ink, and the ivory sheet that had nearly gotten me stoned. The clean papyri my father had obtained for me were gone. I'd exhausted them during the brief writing frenzy that had commenced soon after retrieving my possessions from the cave. Yalfa had brought even less than I. Three tunics, her bedmat, the sistrum, and the Egyptian scissors. Still, we were a spectacle. Over my protests, Father had sent us off in a cart drawn by a royally bedecked horse from Herod Antipas's stable. I'm sure he wanted to impress the Nazarenes, to remind them that Jesus was wedding far above his standing. I offered my new family a smile, hoping to endear myself, but a cart lined with fine woolen rugs, pulled by an imperial horse led by a servant, did nothing to help my cause. Jesus had met us on the village outskirts, and even he'd frowned before greeting us. To worsen matters, Father had also forbidden the wedding under his roof. It was customary for the huppah to be in the bride's house, but he feared annoying Antipas by hosting a marriage the Tetrarch was certain to resent. Nor did Father want village peasants in his house. His refusal to host Jesus and his family must have been a terrible insult to them. And who knew what tales might have reached them of my fornicating, thieving, and blasphemy? I let my eyes drift about the little compound. Three small dwellings were cobbled together within the enclosure, built from stacked stones and held together with mud. I counted five or six rooms opening onto the courtyard. A ladder led to the rooftops, which were covered with reed bundles and packed mud, and I wondered if Yalfa and I would be able to sit up there and share our secrets. I quickly scanned the courtyard. An oven strewn with pots and utensils, firewood, dung pile, mortar, and pestle, loom. There was a sun-cooked vegetable garden and a little stable with four chickens, two sheep, and a goat. A single olive tree. I took it all in. This is where I'll live. I tried not to feel the shock that undulated through me. His family huddled in the shade of the lone tree. I wondered where Jesus' sister was, the one from the market, the yarn spinner. His mother wore a colorless tunic and a pale yellow headscarf with wisps of dark hair escaping the edges. I guessed her to be near the age of my mother, but she was far more frayed by her years. Her face, so like her son's, was well-worn from chores and childbearing. She had a slight rounding in her shoulders, and the corners of her mouth had begun to droop slightly, but I thought how lovely she looked standing there with the sun filtering through the leaves, coins of light on her shoulders. Jesus' confession to me in the cave slipped into my thoughts. In Nazareth, some say I'm Mary's son, not Joseph's. They say I was born from my mother's fornication. Others say my father is Joseph, but that I was illicitly conceived before my parents married. "Welcome, Anna," she said, coming to embrace me. "My daughter Salome was married only a few weeks ago and lives now in Bassara. One daughter has gone, and another has come." There was a plaintive note beneath her smile, and it occurred to me that not only had her daughter left, but her husband had died only 6 months before. The two men were Jesus' brothers, James, 19, and Simon, 17, both dark-skinned and thick-haired like Jesus, with the same short beards and posture, the wide stance, arms crossed, but their eyes had none of the passion and depth Jesus's did. The pregnant woman with the prickly tongue was Judith, married to James, whose age, I would discover, was 15, the same as mine. They looked at me with mute stares. Yalfa removed her bridle. "One would think a two-headed sheep had arrived in your midst." I winced. "Greet my aunt, Yalfa." Jesus grinned. "She's impertinent," James said to Jesus, as if she wasn't standing there. "Rankled," I said. "It's what makes her so dear to me." Jesus, I would discover, was a peacemaker and a provocateur in equal measures, but one could never say which he would be at any given moment. In this moment, he became the peacemaker. You're welcome here, both of you. You are our family now.
You are indeed, Mary said.
Judith remained silent, as did Jesus' brothers. My aunt's honesty had laid the friction bare. When the cart was unpacked, I bid Lavi goodbye. I will miss you, friend, I told him.
Be well, he said, and his eyes watered, causing mine to do the same.
I watched him lead the horse through the gate, listening to the clatter of the empty wagon. When I turned back, the family had dispersed. Only Yaltha and Jesus stood there. He took my hand, and the world righted herself. We were to marry that same day when the sun set, but without ceremony. There would be no procession, no virgins raising their oil lamps and calling out for the groom, no singing, no feasting. By law, a marriage was the act of sexual union, nothing more and nothing less. We would become husband and wife in the solitude of each other's arms. Not allowed to enter the huppa beforehand, I spent the afternoon in the storeroom, where Yaltha had spread her bed mat. Mary had offered to share her room with Yaltha, but she'd declined, preferring to be on her own amid storage jars, food provisions, wool shares, and tools.
Do they think we have the spaciousness of a palace? I said when we were alone, mimicking my soon-to-be sister-in-law.
Yaltha said, "She's impertinent," mocking James's assessment of her. We fell upon each other, laughing. I put my finger to my lips.
Shh, we'll be heard.
Am I required to be well-behaved and quiet?
Never, I replied.
I began to meander about the little room, touching the tools, running my thumb across a stained dye vat.
Are you worried about entering the huppa?
Yaltha asked. I suppose I was. What girl wasn't nervous her first time? But I shook my head. As long as I don't conceive, I will welcome it.
Welcome it, then, for you will have no worries there.
Yaltha had procured blackseed oil for me from a midwife in Sepphoris, a foul liquid more potent than anything my mother had used. I'd been swallowing it for a week. We'd agreed she would conceal it here among her things. Most men knew nothing of the ways in which women avoided pregnancy. When it came to children, they didn't much consider the agony of birth and the possibility of death. They thought instead of God's mandate to be fruitful and multiply. It seemed to be a command God had devised with men in mind, and it was the only one they were universally good at obeying. I didn't think Jesus was like other men, but I'd determined for now to keep the blackseed oil to myself. When it was time, I dressed in a dark blue tunic that my aunt pronounced bluer than the Nile. She smoothed out the wrinkles with her hands and placed the silver headband on my forehead. I draped a white linen shawl over my head. At exactly sunset, I entered the huppa, where Jesus waited. Stepping inside the mud-walled room, I was greeted by the smell of clay and cinnamon and a dim miasma pierced with a beam of orange light falling from a high window. "This will be our abode," Jesus said, stepping back with a sweep of his arm. He wore his blue tasseled cloak. His hair was damp from washing. The room had been arranged with care, whether by Jesus or by the women, I didn't know. My red rugs had been spread across the dirt floor. Two bed mats lay side by side, sprinkled with ground cinnamon, one freshly woven. My mirror, comb, and a neat stack of my clothes had been placed on a bench, with my chest of cedar set into a corner. My incantation bowl sat on a small oak table beneath the window for all the world to see, so exposed I had an irrational urge to hide it somewhere, but I forced myself to remain still. I said, "If you inspected my bowl, I'm sure you saw the graven image inside it. I drew it myself." "Yes, I saw," he answered. I watched for traces of condemnation on his face.
"It doesn't offend you?"
"I'm more concerned with what's in your heart than what's in your bowl.
To look into the bowl is to see into my heart."
He walked over and peered into it.
Could he read Greek?
Taking the bowl in his hands, he turned it as he read aloud, "Lord our God, hear my prayer, the prayer of my heart." Looking up, he held my gaze a moment before continuing. "Bless the largeness inside me, no matter how I fear it. Bless my reed pens and my inks. Bless the words I write. May they be beautiful in your sight. May they be visible to eyes not yet born. When I am dust, sing these words over my bones. She was a voice. He set the bowl back on the table and smiled at me, and I felt the unbearable ache of loving him. I went to him, and there on the thin straw mats in the crumbles of light, I knew my husband, and he knew me. 2. The morning after I became his wife, I woke to hear him repeating the Shema, and then a woman's voice in the courtyard calling, "Anna, it's time to milk the goat." "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord," Jesus intoned. "Can you hear me?" the voice called. "The goat is in need of milking." "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might." "Anna, the goat!" I lay still, eyeing Jesus across the room, ignoring the urgent need for goat milk, listening to his voice rise and fall, the quiet song of it. Somehow in my privileged ignorance it hadn't occurred to me that I would be given an equal share of the chores. The thought was faintly alarming. I'd arrived here unskilled at every conceivable task assigned to women. Jesus faced the window, his back to me. When he lifted his palms, I glimpsed his arms ripple beneath his tunic. The sight summoned forth the memory of last night, moments so innermost and beautiful, they caused an exquisite ache inside me. I let out an involuntary moan, and he finished his prayer and came to sit on the mat beside me. He said, "Do you always sleep so late?" I propped on my elbow, tilting my face to his, and tried to look both coy and innocent. "It's not my fault. I was kept awake last night." His laughter rebounded from the walls to the ceiling, then out through the little window. Pushing the mass and tangle of hair from my face, he drew me against his chest. "Anna, Anna, you have awakened me and made me alive." "Then you have done the same to me," I said. "I have only one fear in being here." He cocked his head.
"And what is that?"
"I have no idea how to milk a goat." He laughed his uproarious laugh once more and pulled me to my feet.
"Get dressed and I will show you. The first thing you must learn is that this is a very particular goat. She only eats winter figs, almond blossoms, and barley cakes, and insists on being fed by hand and having her ears scratched." He carried on like this while I slipped a tunic over my undergarment and tied a scarf around my head, giggling at him under my breath. He was still traveling to Sepphoris to work on the theater, and it seemed he should have been on his way by now, but he appeared to be in no hurry.
"Wait," I said, as he started toward the door. Opening my chest, I retrieved a small pouch, from which I pulled the red thread. "Can you guess where I acquired this?" His brow wrinkled. "It fell from your sleeve the day we met in the market," I said.
"And you kept it?"
"I did, and I shall wear it every day while you're away." I held out my arm. "Tie it on for me."
As he wrapped it about my wrist, he returned to his teasing. "Am I so faint in your thoughts that when I'm away you need this reminder? Without this thread I would forget I had a husband altogether." "Then keep it close," he said, and kissed my cheeks. We found Judith in the stable. The goat was standing defiantly in the water trough, daring the sheep to drink. She was a dainty creature with a white body, a black face, a white beard, and wide-spaced eyes, one of which rotated in and the other out. I thought her outrageously funny-looking.
"She is a menace," Judith said.
"I find her endearing," I replied. My sister-in-law made a derisive noise. "Then you won't mind inheriting her care."
"I don't mind," I said, "but I need instruction."
Sighing, she looked at Jesus as if they might commiserate together over my stupidity. He took my hand, letting his thumb rub against the thread. "I should go. As it is, I'll have to walk at a quick pace so as not to be late." "Your mother has packed your meal," Judith told him, glancing accusingly at me, and I realized that task, too, belonged to me. I'd never cooked anything but ink. When he left us, Judith lifted the goat from the water trough, provoking kicks, bleats, and a splatter of water, and dropped her roughly onto the ground. I watched as the animal lowered her head and butted Judith's thigh. Already, I felt an affinity with the creature. During those first months, it was plain to everyone, including me, that I'd spent my life as a pampered rich girl. Yalfa was of little help. She'd read Socrates, but knew nothing about pounding grain into flour or drying flax. Jesus's mother gathered me under her wing, trying to teach me, and protected me as best she could from Judith's reproaches, which gurgled like an unceasing spring. I didn't light the dung fire correctly. I left chaff in the wheat. I left wool on the sheep. I could not cook pottage without scorching the lentils. My goat cheese tasted like hooves. Judith complained of me even more vociferously when others were about, notably my husband, telling him once that I was less useful than a lame camel. She not only disparaged my domestic skills, but I half suspected her of efforts to disrupt them. When it was my turn to pound the wheat, the pestle went missing. When I laid the fire, oddly, the dung was wet. Once, when Mary instructed me to latch the gate, it miraculously unlatched itself and the chickens escaped. The only task I excelled at was caring for the goat, whom I named Delilah. I fed her fruit and cucumbers and brought her a little basket that she liked to toss about with her head. I talked to her. "Hello, girl. Do you have milk for me today? Are you hungry? Do you want your ears scratched? Do you find Judith as annoying as I do?" And she occasionally responded with a string of bleats. Some days I tied a piece of rope about her neck and fastened it to my girdle, and she accompanied me as I went about my chores and waited for the sun to slope toward the hills and Jesus to return. At the sight of him, Delilah and I would rush to the gate, where I embraced him, oblivious to the stares of his family. James and Simon took fun in mocking our devotion, which Jesus took in stride, laughing with them. There was truth in their teasing, but I didn't find it as good-natured as my husband. They taunted him out of jealousy. Simon, 2 years from having a wife, was eager for the intimacies of marriage, and James and Judith's union was like that of two yoked oxen. 3. One hot day in the month of Elul, while the courtyard baked, I milked Delilah in the stable, then placed the ewer of frothy milk outside the gate, where the sheep couldn't capsize it. When I turned back, Delilah was in the water trough again. She'd taken to standing and sometimes sitting in it for long periods. I made no effort to deter her. I thought of climbing in myself. As Mary approached us with a basket of grain, however, I tried to lure her out. "Leave her," she said, chuckling. She looked tired and flushed with heat. Now that Judith's time was near, we'd taken over her portion of the chores, the bulk of which fell to Mary, since I was still an apprentice. I took the basket from her. Even I could toss grain to chickens. She leaned against the gate. "Do you know what we should do, Anna? Just the two of us? We should go to the village mikveh and immerse ourselves. Yaltha can remain here with Judith in case the baby decides to come." I gestured at Delilah. "I know. I envy her, too." She laughed. "Let's shirk our work and go." A lovely impish light had come into her eyes. A line of women had formed outside the stone enclosure that housed the pool, not because they'd suddenly grown devout, but because, like us, they craved a respite from the heat. We joined it, clutching our drying rags and clean tunics. Mary called out a greeting to the toothless old midwife who would soon attend Judith, and was greeted in return, but without enthusiasm. The women ahead of us stole glances at me, whispering and holding themselves stiffly, and I realized that my ill repute had followed me from Sepphoris. I couldn't tell if Mary noticed, or if, for my sake, she pretended not to. When we stepped inside the cool dwelling and descended into the mikveh, the women's undertones grew louder. "Yes, it's the chief scribe's daughter, the one sent away for promiscuity. They say she was nearly stoned for thievery. What reason could Mary's son have for marrying her?" Overhearing their gossip, the women behind us, including the midwife, refused to enter the water after me, preferring to wait until I'd vacated. My cheeks stung with humiliation, not because I cared what this puerile gaggle of women thought, but because Mary had witnessed the indignities. "Pay them no mind," she told me. "Turn the other cheek." But the lovely light had gone from her eyes. As we walked home, she said,
Jesus and I have also been the recipients of this kind of malice. They called me promiscuous, too. They said Jesus was conceived before my marriage, and some said he didn't belong to Joseph. I didn't tell her Jesus had spoken to me of these things. I waited for her to refute their accusations, but she said nothing, refusing to defend herself. She took my hand as we walked, and I felt how difficult, how bold, how loving it was for her to bear herself to me like this. "Jesus suffered more than I," she said. "He was branded as a child who was born outside of marriage. Some in the village shun him to this day. As a boy, he would come home from synagogue school with bruises and scrapes, always getting into a fight with his tormentors. I told him what I told you. Pay them no mind and turn the other cheek. Their hearts are boulders and their heads are straw." I've heard Jesus use those same words. He learned well, and his suffering didn't harden him. It's always a marvel when one's pain doesn't settle into bitterness, but brings forth kindness instead. "I think the marvel has a lot to do with his mother," I told her. She patted my arm and turned her concern back to me. "I know you suffer too, Anna, not just from gossip and scandal, but daily at the hands of Judith. I'm sorry she makes it difficult for you." I can do nothing right in her eyes. "She envies your happiness." Abruptly, she guided us off the path to a fig tree and motioned for me to sit in the green shade. "There's a story I must tell you," she said. "Last year, when Jesus was close to 20, well before you came along, Joseph attempted to betroth him. My husband was ailing then, weak and short of breath, with a blue hue about his mouth." She paused, closing her eyes, and I saw the freshness of her grief. "I think he knew he would die soon, and it spurred him to fulfill his duty and find his first son a wife." A memory stirred. That evening Jesus had asked me to become his betrothed. He'd said his father had tried to arrange a marriage for him, but he hadn't agreed to it. Judith's father, Uriah, owns a small parcel of land and keeps sheep, even hiring two shepherds, Mary said. He was a friend to Joseph, one who paid no attention to lingering stories of Jesus' birth. Joseph intended to seek a betrothal for Jesus with Judith. The revelation dazed me. "Of course it never happened," she continued. "Our son had some notion he wouldn't marry at all. That was a great shock to us. Not to marry would have made him even more of a pariah. We pleaded with him, but his reason had to do with God's wishes, and he asked his father not to approach Uriah. Joseph complied." The sunlight broke through the limbs and I frowned, more from confusion than the glare. Why should Judith be envious of me if she knows nothing about this? But she does know. Joseph had been so assured of the betrothal he had already hinted his intention to Uriah. Judith's mother came to me, saying her daughter was pleased at the notion. Joseph, poor man. He felt to blame and was relieved when James offered to betroth Judith instead. James was barely 19, so young. Naturally, the story spread throughout Nazareth. How embarrassed Judith must have been, getting the secondborn because the firstborn declined. How hard it must have been for her to see me ride through the gate only months later. Jesus believed his decision was right, Mary was saying. Still, he felt sorry for the shame it caused Judith's family, and he went to Uriah and humbled himself, saying he meant no disrespect, that he was uncertain if he would marry at all, that he still wrestled with God over it. He praised Judith as worthy, her price far above rubies. This satisfied Uriah. It didn't apparently satisfy Judith. I was squeezing a handful of my tunic so tightly that when I let go, my knuckles throbbed. Jesus had told me nothing of this. Mary read my thought. "My son didn't want you burdened with this. He believed it would make it more difficult for you, but I thought it would help you understand Judith better, and perhaps make it easier." I said, "I am sure you are right, but all I could think was that my husband had a separate place inside himself where he kept certain privacies that I would never know. But did I not also have such a place?" Mary got to her feet, and when I stood, too, she faced me. "I'm glad my son changed his mind about marriage. I don't know if it was God who changed it or if it was you." She cradled my cheeks in her hands. I've never seen him so glad of heart as he is now.
As we walked on, I told myself I would let Jesus have his hidden place that was his alone. We had our togetherness. Why should we not have our separateness? 4. I began to slip away from the straw mat while Jesus slept, light a lamp, and creak open my chest. Sitting cross-legged on the floor, trying to make no sound, I would stretch out one of my papyri and read. I often wondered if Jesus had ever opened my cedar chest and peered inside it. We'd never spoken of the contents, and though he'd read the prayer in my bowl and knew the depth of my desire, he hadn't broached the topic again. One night he woke to find me huddled in the small spout of light, poring over my half-finished story of Yaltha's travails in Alexandria, which I'd embarked upon during those last insufferable days before leaving Sepphoris. Coming to stand over me, he gazed into the open chest. "These are the scrolls you buried in the cave?" The question stopped my breath. Yes, there were 13 of them buried there, but shortly after digging them up, I added several more. My mind traveled to the 3 scrolls that contained my tales of terror. I held out the scroll I'd been reading and felt my hand shake. This one is an account of my aunt's life in Alexandria. I regret I wasn't able to finish it before running out of papyrus. As he took it, I realized this text, too, was replete with brutality. In it, I'd progressed no further than describing the mistreatment my aunt had endured at the hands of her husband, Rubel, and I'd spared no detail of his cruelty. I suppressed an urge to take the scroll back. No one had ever read my words but Yaltha, and I suddenly felt bared, as if I'd been lifted out of my skin. Jesus sat beside me and leaned into the lamplight. Upon finishing, he said, "Your story caused your aunt's suffering to lift off the papyrus and enter inside me. I felt her suffering as my own, and she was made new to me." Heat started in my chest, a kind of radiance that spread through my arms. "When I write, that's what I most hope for," I told him, struggling to remain composed. "Do the other scrolls contain stories such as this one?" he asked. I described my collection of narratives, even my tales of terror. "You will write again, Anna. One day you will." He was saying what had never been acknowledged out loud, that the privilege was not possible now. Even he, the eldest son, could not make a way for me to write and study, not in this poor compound in Nazareth where there were no coins for papyri, where men scrabbled for work and women toiled from daybreak to day's end. Women's duties and customs were inviolable here, more so even than in Sepphoris. The leisure and affront of making inks and writing words were as unthinkable as spinning gold from flax, but doing so would not be lost to me forever. That's what he was telling me. He blew out the lamp and we returned to our mats. His words had flooded me with an odd mixture of hope and disappointment. I told myself I would put aside my desire, that it would wait. The thought saddened me, but from that night I did not doubt he understood my longing. 5. On the day that Jesus and I had been married a full year, Mary patted my belly and teased, "Have you got a baby in there yet?" Overhearing this, Jesus cast his mother an amused look that cut through me. Was he too waiting and hoping for a child? We were in the courtyard huddled over an inventive new oven Jesus had made out of clay and straw, the 3 of us staring inside at balls of dough clinging to its smooth, curved walls. Mary and I had taken turns throwing the fistfuls of dough against the sides while Jesus praised our efforts. Unsurprisingly, 2 of my dough balls had refused to stick and landed in the hot coals at the bottom. The smell of burned bread was everywhere. Across the compound, Judith stepped from her doorway and wrinkled her nose. "Have you burned the bread again, Anna?" She glanced sideways at Jesus. "How do you know it was I who did so and not my mother-in-law?" I asked. "I know the same way I know it was your goat who ate my cloth and not the chickens." Of course she would bring that up. I'd let Delilah roam free in the compound and she'd eaten Judith's precious cloth. You would think I'd put the cloth on a plate and fed it to her. In a perfectly timed moment, Delilah emitted a forlorn bleat and Jesus broke into laughter. "She overheard you, Judith, and wishes to be forgiven." Judith huffed away, her baby Sarah tied onto her back. The child had been born 7 months ago, and already Judith was pregnant again. I felt a wave of pity for her. Mary was removing the small loaves from the oven, tossing them into a basket. "I'll pack these for your journey," she said to Jesus. He would leave tomorrow as a journeyman, traveling from village to village as a stonemason and woodworker. The theater in Sepphoris was finished, and jobs there had disappeared as Herod Antipas erected a new capital to the north, named Tiberias for the Roman emperor. Jesus could have found employment there, of course, but Antipas had stupidly, wantonly built the city atop a cemetery, and only those who cared little for the purity laws would work there. My husband was an outspoken critic of the purity laws, probably too outspoken for his own good, but I think he'd been relieved to have a reason not to be part of the Tetrarch's ambitions. I slid my arm about Jesus' waist, as if to tether him. "Not only will Delilah and I remain unforgiven, but my husband is leaving with all our bread," I said, making an effort to disguise my sadness. "I wish you didn't have to go. If I had my way, I would stay, but there's little work for me in Nazareth, you know that. Don't people in Nazareth need plows and yokes and roof beams? Jobs here will go more readily to James and Simon than to me. I'll try not to remain away too long. I'll go first to Jaffa, and if I find no work there, I'll go on to Exaloth and Dibira." Jaffa. It was the village Tabitha had been banished to. A year and a half had passed since I'd seen her, but she was not gone from my thoughts. I'd told Jesus about her, holding nothing back. I'd even sung some of her songs for him. "When you're in Jaffa, would you seek word of Tabitha for me?" I asked. He hesitated only slightly. "I'll inquire about her, Anna. But the news, if there is any, may not be what you hope to hear." I scarcely heard him. Her song about the blind girls was playing unbidden in my head. In the afternoon, I found Jesus mixing mud-brick mortar to repair the crumbling stone in the compound wall, mud to his elbows, and I couldn't bear to keep my secret from him any longer. I handed him a cup of water. I said, "Do you remember when you told me some men possessed an inner knowledge that caused them to leave their families and go out as prophets and preachers?" He looked at me, bemused, squinting through the sunlight. "You thought that you yourself might even be among them?" I continued. "Well, I too have my own knowing inside, that I'm not meant for motherhood, but for something else. Such an impossible thing to explain. You're talking about the prayer in your bowl, the stories you've written." "Yes." I took his hands in mine, even though they were caked. "What if my words could, like men's, prophesy or preach? Would that not be worth the sacrifice? I was so young, 16 then, and exorbitantly hopeful. I still believed I would not have long to wait. Some miracle would intervene. The sky would part. God would rain down papyri." I studied his face. I saw regret, uncertainty. Not to have children was considered a great misfortune, a thing worse than death. I thought suddenly of the law that permitted a man to divorce his childless wife after 10 years, but unlike my mother, I didn't fear that possibility. Jesus would never countenance such a law. My fear lay in disappointing him. "But do you need to make the sacrifice now?" he said. "There's time. Your writing will be there for you one day." I understood more clearly. When he said one day, he meant one faraway day. "I do not want children," I whispered. This was my deeper secret, but I'd never spoken it aloud. Good women had babies. Good women wanted babies. It was pressed upon every girl precisely what good women did and did not do. We lugged those dictates around like temple stones. A good woman was modest. She was quiet. She covered her head when she went out. She didn't speak with men. She tended her domestic tasks. She obeyed and served her husband. She was faithful to him. Above all, she gave him children. Better yet, sons. I waited for Jesus to respond, but he dipped his trowel in the mortar and smoothed it over the stones. Had he ever prodded me to be a good woman? Not once. I waited several moments, and when he didn't speak, I turned to leave.
Do you wish, then, to bed apart? He asked.
No, oh no. But I do wish to use the midwife's herbs. I already take them.
His eyes held mine for so long I fought not to look away. They were tinged with disappointment that slowly softened, then ebbed. He said,
Little Thunder, I won't judge the knowing in your heart, or what choice you make.
It was the first time he spoke the pet name he would call me until the end. I accepted it as an endearment. He heard the quake that lived at my center, and he didn't seek to silence it.
6.
The days he was away crept on tiny, unhurried feet. Sometimes in the evening, my feeling of aloneness was so great, I snuck Delilah into our room and fed her citrus peels. Other times I carried my mat to the storeroom and slept beside Yalfa. I marked Jesus' absence with pebbles, adding one each day atop his sleeping mat, watching the little pile grow. 9, 10, 11. On the 12th day, I woke knowing Jesus would return before dark, bearing some sort of propitious news. I couldn't concentrate on my tasks. In the afternoon, Mary came upon me staring idly at a spider that dangled from the lip of a water jug.
Are you well? She asked.
Jesus will come today, I know it. She didn't question my certainty. She said, I'll ready his meal. I bathed myself and dabbed clove oil behind my ears. I let my hair loose and dressed in the dark blue tunic he loved. I poured wine and set out bread. Over and over I went to the doorway and looked toward the gate. A blaze of yellow on the hill, the first grains of darkness floating in the air, dusk skulking across the compound. He arrived with the last trace of light, bearing his tools and enough wages to replenish our wheat stores and add a lamb to the stable. In the privacy of our room, he gathered me into an embrace. I could smell the weariness on him. Filling his cup, I said, What tidings do you bring? He described his days, the work he'd been hired to do. And Tabitha, do you have any word of her? He touched the bench beside him. Sit. Was the news so grave I must sit to receive it? I sank down close to him. I was hired by a man in Jaffa to fashion a new door for his house. Everyone in the village knew of Tabitha, including the man's wife, who said that few had ever seen her, and most feared her. When I asked why this was, she said Tabitha was possessed by demons and kept locked inside. This was not the favorable news I'd expected. Would you take me to her? She's no longer there, Anna. The woman said she was sold to a man from Jericho, a landowner.
Sold? She's a slave in his house?
It seems so. I asked others in Jaffa about her, and they told me the same story. I laid my head in his lap and felt his hand stroke my back. 7. Throughout the year that followed, I grew accustomed to Jesus' absences. The temporary loss of him became less like a spear in my side and more of a splinter in my foot. I went about my chores, relieved when I'd completed them and could sit with Mary or Yalfa and beg for stories of Jesus' boyhood or tales of Alexandria. I thought sometimes of my parents, an hour's walk away, and of Judas, who was I knew not where, and a gnawing forlornness would rise in me. There'd been no word from any of them. I tried not to think of Tabitha, enslaved to a stranger. Whenever Jesus was away, I wore the red thread on my wrist, as was my custom. But early in the spring, on a day when my mind could settle on nothing, I noticed how frayed the thread had become over the past year. So wizened, I feared it would soon wear apart. Touching it with my fingertip, I assured myself that if such a thing happened, it would signify nothing ominous. But then I thought of the ink splotch in my incantation bowl, the gray cloud over my head. It was hard to imagine that meant nothing. No, I would not risk a broken thread. I undid the knot and slid my tattered bracelet into its goatskin pouch. I was tightening the cord when I heard Mary shout from the courtyard, Come quickly! Jesus has returned!
For the past 2 weeks, he'd been in Bassara making cabinets for a winemaker and staying with his sister Salome. I knew Mary was anxious for news of her daughter. Salome is well, he reported when the flurry of greetings had subsided. But I have bitter news. Her husband has a weakness in his leg and arm, and a slur in his voice. He no longer leaves the house. I looked at Mary, how she gathered herself, her arms wrapping about her sides, her body saying what her mouth did not. Salome will be a widow soon. That night, all of us except Judith and the children huddled about the cook fire, speculating about Salome's husband and sharing stories. When the heat had nearly gone from the embers, James turned to Jesus. Will you make the Passover pilgrimage for us this year? James, Simon, and Mary had traveled to the temple in Jerusalem the year before, while the rest of us stayed home to work and tend the animals. It was Jesus' turn to go, but he vacillated. I don't yet know, he said. But someone must go from our family, James responded, sounding annoyed. Why do you hesitate? Can't you leave work behind for those few days? It isn't that. I'm struggling to understand if God wishes me to go at all. The temple has become a den of thieves, James. James rolled his eyes skyward. Must you always concern yourself with such things? We have a duty to sacrifice an animal at Passover. Yes, and the poor bring their animals, and the priests refuse to accept them, claiming they're blemished, and then they charge exorbitant prices for another one. What he says is true, Simon offered. Shall we speak of something else? Mary said. But Jesus pressed on. The priests insist on having their own currency, and when the poor try to exchange their coins, the money changers charge them excessive rates. James stood. Would you force me to make the trip again this year? Do you care more for the poor than your brother? Jesus answered, aren't the poor also my brothers and sisters? The next morning, as the sun stirred awake, Jesus trekked into the hills to pray. It was his daily habit. At other times, I would find him sitting cross-legged on the floor with his prayer shawl drawn over his head, unmoving, eyes closed. It had been so since we married, this devotion, this feasting on God, and I'd never minded it. But today, seeing him walk away in the half-light, I understood what, until now, I'd only glimpsed. God was the ground beneath him, the sky over him, the air he breathed, the water he drank. It made me uneasy. I prepared his breakfast, trimming corn from the husk and parching it over the fire, the sweet aroma drifting over the compound. I glanced repeatedly toward the gate, as if God lurked out there, ready to pluck my husband from me. When he returned, we sat together beneath the olive tree. I watched him wrap bread around a hunk of goat cheese and eat hungrily, saving the corn, his favorite, for last. He was quiet. Finally, he said, when I saw my brother-in-law's infirmity, I was moved with pity. Everywhere I look, there's suffering, Anna, and I spend my days making cabinets for a rich man. You spend your days caring for your family, I said, perhaps too sharply. He smiled. Don't worry, Little Thunder. I'll do what I must. He wrapped an arm about me. Passover is soon. Let us go to Jerusalem. 8. We took the pilgrim road, leaving the green hills of Galilee and descending into the dense thickets of the Jordan River Valley, traveling through stretches of wilderness filled with jackals. At night we put out the fire early, and clutching our staffs, slept beneath little lean-tos we fashioned from brush. We were on our way to Bethany, just outside Jerusalem, where we would lodge with Jesus' friends, Lazarus, Martha, and Mary. The Jericho road was the last, most treacherous part of our journey, not because of jackals, but because of the robbers who hid in the barren cliffs that lined the valley. At least the road was well-traveled. For miles now we'd trodden behind a man with two sons and a priest wearing an elaborate robe, but I couldn't help feeling uneasy. Sensing my nervousness, Jesus began telling me stories of his family's Passover visits with his friends in Bethany when he was a boy. When I was 8, Jesus said, Lazarus and I came upon a dove merchant who was treating his birds cruelly, poking them with sticks and feeding them pebbles. We waited until he left his stall, opened the cages, and set them free before he returned. He accused us of stealing, and our fathers were compelled to pay him a full price. My family was forced to remain in Bethany 2 extra weeks while Father and I worked to pay the debt. At the time, I thought it was worth it, the sight of the birds flying away. Imagining them flapping off to freedom, I didn't notice the way his steps slowed and his story ceased mid-sentence. Anna. He pointed toward a bend in the distance, at a heap of white robe spattered with red lying on the side of the road. I thought, someone has cast off his garment. Then I saw the shape of a person beneath it. Ahead of us, the father and his sons, and then the priest, came to a halt, judging, it seemed, whether the person was dead or alive. He's been set upon by robbers, Jesus said, scanning the rocky terrain as if they might still be nearby. Come. He walked quickly, while I scampered to keep up. Already the others had passed by the wounded man, giving him a wide berth. Jesus knelt beside the figure as I stood behind him, dredging up the courage to look. A soft moan drifted up. It's a woman, Jesus said. I gazed down then, seeing her but not seeing her, my mind unwilling to yield to what was before me. My Lord and my God, it's Tabitha. Her face was smeared with blood, but I saw no wound. The gash is on her scalp, Jesus said, pointing to a mass of sticky, dark blood in her hair. I stooped and wiped her face with my robe. Her eyes fluttered. She stared at me, blinking, and I was certain she knew me. The stub of her tongue thrashed about in her mouth, looking for a way to speak my name. Is she dead? A voice called. A tall young man approached. I could tell from his dialect and dress he was a Samaritan, and I tensed reflexively. Jews had nothing to do with Samaritans, regarding them as worse than Gentiles. She's wounded, Jesus said. The man pulled out his water skin, bent, and tipped it to Tabitha's lips. Her mouth opened, her neck arched upward. She looked like a featherless baby bird craning for food. Jesus dropped his hand onto the man's shoulder. You're Samaritan, yet you give a Galilean your water. The man made no reply, and Jesus unwound his girdle and set about binding Tabitha's wound. The Samaritan hoisted her onto Jesus's back, and we walked the rest of the way with excruciating slowness. 9. I heard the slap of sandals in the courtyard, then women's voices, high-pitched and eager. Coming, we're coming! Tabitha groaned. I said, you're safe now. Throughout the long, torturous day, Tabitha had appeared inert, as if sleeping, rousing a little only when the men transferred her from one to the other, and each time I'd patted her face and offered her water. The Samaritan had parted with us a short while before we'd reached Bethany, pressing a copper coin into my hands. A sesterce. See that she has lodging and food, he'd said. I began to protest, but Jesus spoke up. Let him give his coin. I dropped it into my pouch. Now the creak of a latch and two women appeared, short, thick-waisted, with round, plump faces that were nearly identical. Their exuberance faded as they glimpsed Tabitha, but they asked no questions and hurried us to a room, where we laid her on a pillowed bed mat. I'll tend her, the one called Mary said to us. Go, take the evening meal with Martha and Lazarus. You must be hungry and tired. When I tarried, reluctant to leave Tabitha, Jesus gave me a little tug. Lazarus was not as I'd expected. He was slight of build with a sallow face and weak, watery eyes. So unlike his sisters. He and Jesus greeted each other like brothers, kissing cheeks and embracing. We gathered about a round slat table that rested on the floor, an arrangement new to me. In Sepphoris, we'd reclined on plush couches around a long table. In Nazareth, we'd had no table at all, but held bowls in our lap and sat on the ground. Who's the injured girl? Lazarus asked. Her name is Tabitha, I answered. I knew her as a girl in Sepphoris. She was my friend, my only friend. She was sent away to live with relatives who sold her to a man in Jericho. I don't know how she came to be beaten and left on the side of the road. Lazarus replied, she may stay with us as long as she wishes. The house was clay-baked with tiled floors, dyed woolen mats, and its own mikveh, an abode far better than our house in Nazareth, but there was only one room for guests, and that night Jesus slept on the roof, while I made my bed beside Tabitha. While she slept, I lay in the dark and listened to her breathe, a croaking sound that erupted at times into puffs and moans. Her small, lissome body, the one that had danced with such grace and abandon, was bony and clenched as if in a perpetual state of recoil. I could see the protuberances of her cheekbones like sharp little hills on her face. Mary had bathed her and dressed her in a clean tunic and covered her wound with a plaster of olive oil and onion to draw the pus. The sour smell of it hung over the room. I longed to speak to her. She'd wakened earlier, but only long enough to drink a full cup of lemon water. I thought of Lazarus's words. Until he'd spoken them, I'd not considered where Tabitha would go. What would become of her? If I had my way, I'd take her to live with us in Nazareth, but even if the entire family welcomed her, which was